I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is investigative journalist and author Bob Woodward. He's joined in conversation by Audrey Cooper, editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle. And now, join Marcy Glazer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Bob Woodward and Audrey Cooper.
Bob Woodward is here with us this evening, and we are so grateful. An associate editor of the Washington Post, where he has worked since 1971, he is widely considered one of the finest, if not the finest, political investigative reporter of all time in U.S. history. Mr. Woodward is the recipient of nearly every American Journalism Prize, including two Pulitzer Prizes, first in 1973 for his reporting on the Watergate scandal, and then again in 2003 as the lead reporter for coverage of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He is the best-selling author of 19 books. He has written about every U.S. president since Richard Nixon, a total of 9. But in all of his years in covering politics, he has never encountered a president like President Trump. His latest book, Fear, Trump in the White House, takes us inside, revealing how President Trump makes decisions on major foreign policy and domestic policy issues and how his presidency has evolved. Appearing with Mr. Woodward this evening is Audrey Cooper. Her first time on this stage, Ms. Cooper became editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle in 2015, making her the first woman to hold the position in the company's 153-year history. Friends, please welcome Bob Woodward and Audrey Cooper to the JCCSF stage.
Mr. Woodward, welcome to San Francisco.
Thank you.
So I want to start off with this book. It shattered first week sales records at Simon & Schuster. As Marcy said, you've written 19 of these books. Were you surprised by the commercial success right off the bat?
No, it's really not about the book or me. It's about Trump. And Trump is a magnet for because people, I mean, in just talking with people here earlier at a reception, they are electrified, perplexed, and distressed.
Fearful.
And yeah, fearful. And I mean, the title of the book, Fear, came from Trump. And 3 years ago, a young reporter at the Post and I were interviewing Trump, and we kind of figured, well, he's not going to be elected president, so we'll ask serious questions and take the high road. So we talked about power, because that's what the presidency is really about. And Obama had said, he was president at that time, Obama had said, well, real power is not having to use violence. And so we asked Trump, what's real power? And it was almost a Shakespearean aside, like Hamlet turning to the audience and saying, this is what's really going on, and this is what I think. And Trump said, real power is, I don't even like to use the term, but real power is fear. If you do, as I was able to do 2 years of reporting, that's his way of operating. He scares the bejesus out of everyone. And the closer they are to him, the more distress they have about the way he's conducting the presidency and his policy-making process, which in a way doesn't exist, because his idea of policymaking is, can I ask the audience a question?
You can ask any question.
How many people have a to-do list? You know, where you, okay. 2 years of work, Trump does not have a to-do list. No, it's all impulse. It's all the moment. It's what's on television. And so the tragedy is, if you think about this, presidents can do really great things for this country. They have over the centuries. And this is a time of a kind of peace and a kind of economic prosperity, and good things could be done. But with Trump, it's and so the book opens with Gary Cohen, the economic advisor to Trump. Cohen had been the very successful president of Goldman Sachs, and he lifts a paper off Trump's desk because he realizes Trump is ordering the withdrawal from the South Korean trade agreement, which will trigger potentially an unraveling of the relationship and the very top secret program to detect North Korean missile launches. And Cohen was traumatized and just, you know, I'm going to take it off his desk. Of course, Trump didn't notice. And I mean, it would be really interesting if you could have a time-lapse camera in the Oval Office of what
there
comes to...
One.
Yes, there might be one. That's right. Nixon never thought of that. And, you know, what comes on his desk, what gets signed, what disappears, because this is a routine policy. Now, the paper I referred to when the book came out, Trump denied, said, oh, Gary Cohn would never do that. If he did, I'd fire him. In the book, I print the document that was lifted from the desk and the folder that Cohen put it in. Of course, that is replicated in the book on page 9, and Trump did not get that far in the book.
You know, that part, that it's a prologue. The Cohn anecdote is a prologue to the book, which then goes back to the campaign.
Yes.
And when I was reading it as an editor, I thought, oh, good, he led with the good stuff first, and then he's going back to the rest of it. Why'd you break that out at the beginning as a prologue?
Oh, I knew you were going to re-edit the book. Because it's action. It was not known. It symbolizes the breakdown, the nervous breakdown of executive authority. And it not only involves Gary Cohen, but Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, and Secretary of Defense Mattis, who Cohen asked to go see Trump and say, you can't get out of the South Korea trade agreement because it will be a catastrophe. So you have a series of players, you have action, and I actually had the picture of the memo in the folder, and I remember putting it in the book and going, ha, he can't deny this. But of course
spoiler
he did.
Alert. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So some people have called this book a bookend to your first book about Nixon. Do you think that's a fair characterization? And you have outlined in the book some differences between what's going on with the Trump administration and the over-conflation of that with Watergate.
Yeah. First, you have to go back. What was Watergate? And Watergate was actually an attempt to subvert the process of nominating and electing presidents in 1972. It wasn't just a burglary. It was dirty tricks, wiretapping, all kinds of things. And there were a series of wars that Nixon conducted against the anti-war movement, against the press, 17 wiretaps on Nixon White House people or directly on reporters, a war on the justice system, the cover-up, and in the end, Nixon's war against history to kind of deny it. And it was Senator Ervin who ran the Senate Watergate Committee who asked the question, well, why? Watergate. And he said it was a lust for political power. And I think that's absolutely true. I think this is the overlap with Trump. I think Trump, who knows something about lust, also lusts. You're grimacing. Okay,
it's a JCC.
You're supposed to be.
Conversation.
Okay. Oh, wait till we get to the good stuff. But that it is that there is something about Trump and run for the presidency, which has not been fully explained. It's almost like he was well known. He was a celebrity. And so this is the next big thing. I think I'll run for president with no concept, no real interest in the history of the office and the mechanics of governing and the responsibility of the president. And so it was again one of his impulses. And I think one of the failings in the media that we have, and I in particular, is understanding the psychology of it for Trump. How many people here have been elected president of the United States? None. Not even
not,
you.
Not by the popular vote.
Yes, right. And but Trump has, and he did it in defiance of the party and of the odds and the traditions and the political inexperience. So he got to the White House by himself, and I found, and there's scenes in the book of he's talking about some issue, and cabinet officers will say, "Where did you get that idea?" He said, "Well, I've had it for 30 years, and if you disagree with me, you are wrong." And so Trump is, there is something that, in doing books about nine presidents, I think all presidents are isolated. I think Trump the most isolated by far in a very dramatic way. And people, it's what George Kennan, the father of the containment strategy in the 1940s, called the treacherous curtain of deference that just falls down when people get in the Oval Office. And I've had people, White House aides in all presidencies, cabinet, I'm going to go in and I'm going to tell the president the truth. And then they melt and fade. And so, and as we know, Trump likes praise. And so anyone who challenges him is, I mean, now Kirstjen Nielsen, the head of Homeland Security, is out. And it's Trump just, you know, I'm going to weed out anything that isn't perfect. And, of course, nothing is perfect. So we talk to people in the White and say, "Do you think your job is in jeopardy?" And they burst out laughing because they know their job is in jeopardy, always.
One of the themes in the book that I got out of it is that he seems to surround himself with these people who are on one hand sycophantic, and on the other hand, they know that what's going on is not normal, but they kind of put up with it anyway. Is that everybody that's working in the administration, or is that just the people who are talking to the press?
Well, you know, I found people who weren't talking to the press in the detail and the luxury of time. You could hear about things and then find people who had diaries and documents, and so you could lend and present an authoritative explanation of how, for instance, Trump decided to levy steel tariffs. I mean, did it all on his own. It's his chief of staff, his economic advisors didn't know, and he called in the steel executives early in the morning and then just said, "Where steel tariffs are imposed." And as almost all economists will tell you that actually makes no sense, that the trade deficits with countries like China and in Europe Trump is obsessed with, they actually help the American consumer. And people have tried to tell him this, and he just will not listen. So it's isolation, and it's Reince Priebus, who was Trump's first chief of staff, didn't last long. But I quote him in the book saying, it's not a team of rivals in the Trump White House. It's a team of predators. And he says, and then he goes on, there's a snake and a hippopotamus and a gorilla and this is the chief of staff. That it's not Nancy Pelosi saying that it's a team of predators. It's the person who's supposed to be. So I'm quite frankly more and more alarmed as I get into reporting for a possible second Trump book.
Everybody's scared of what the second Trump book will say. Do you remember the first time you met the president?
Yes. It was in the 80s. Met Trump, and he had just published his book, Art of the Deal, and my colleague at the time, Carl Bernstein, said, oh, this, we've got to go meet Trump. And he'd run into Trump, and, you know, Trump is just... And this is the way he is. And he said to Carl,
so this was
he
like
said,
in the 90s?
No, the 80s, like 87, 88 or something. And Trump said, oh, you and Woodward have to come up and talk to me. Just think of it, Bernstein and Woodward and Trump. and Carl said, you know, we have
tongue.
To do this. And I said, why? And he said, well, let's do it. And we taped the interview, and I'm embarrassed to say I lost the tape. Like Nixon. I mean, it was just kind of, where's the tape?
Was it like a tape recorder tape?
Yes, yeah, it was. Huh. And I've offered to people who work for me $1,000 cash reward if they find
the tape.
Maybe
you could ask the Russians.
Yeah.
I might have it. But what was it like when you finally met him?
Well, then, yeah, I mean, he was, you know, it's Art of the Deal, it's bluster. I was saying tonight at the reception, I think this bluster and tweeting and his whole public persona is a disguise for what he really is. He's a showman. He likes the show. And he regrettably has too little interest in governing. And I, you know, that's the job. I from doing 9 presidents, I've asked myself this question, what's the job of the president? And my answer is the job of the president is to figure out what the next stage of good is for a majority of people in the country, not a base, not one party, not interest groups. But we could put up a board here. We say, this is the next stage of good. These are the things the country needs to do. And in 2 years of work, it never comes up with Trump. I mean, that's the real tragedy that... With all this power and all this focus, and I honestly don't think he gets up in the morning and thinks, how can I screw up the country or screw things up? I think he is just, it's all about him. And that is dangerous when you get into some of these foreign policy issues and confrontations.
So let's talk about the Mueller report. It exists now. We have a summary of it. Do you think the full thing will ever come out?
I have a copy of it in my suitcase back here. Would you like to see it?
I would like to see it.
A San Francisco Chronicle exclusive.
I can finally yell, stop the presses. I've always wanted to do that.
Would you do it?
Absolutely.
What?
Yeah.
And then suppose there was sensitive stuff in there, and you got a call from the attorney general.
Oh man, now it's a journalism.
What?
Ethics. Yeah, you're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, and the FBI director said you're jeopardizing national security, Ms. Cooper. And we're asking that you not publish. What would you do?
I think there are probably things in that report that are counterintelligence information that probably should not be printed.
Yes, I agree. But then how do you... You've stopped the presses. And, you know, a little bit impulsively,
well,
I think.
I mean,
you can't say, well, there'll be no Chronicle for 5 days while we figure out what we can print.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Is.
You're listening to investigative journalist Bob Woodward, whose latest book is Fear, Trump in the White House. He's joined in conversation by Audrey Cooper, editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Catherine Graham, who was the owner, publisher of the Washington Post, after Nixon resigned, sent a private letter to Carl Bernstein and myself. In fact, she wrote it out by hand on legal yellow pad, and Bernstein got the original, and I got a Xerox. And it said... It's a great letter, and it was supposed to be private, but she published it in her memoirs. You know, you can never trust publishers. And it said, okay, now you two, you did some of the stories, Nixon's gone. Now don't start thinking too highly of yourselves. And let me give you some advice. She said, and the advice is, beware the demon pomposity. And the demon pomposity stalks the halls of the media, politicians, business, you name it. And it is an infection that consumes lots of people. And I think it's a mistake. Too often we become... And it looks like I'm a Republican senator I know quite well. And I was saying, I'm worried about my business, the media, that we're too involved and too judgmental and not empirical enough. And he said, oh, don't worry about your business at all. Almost everyone has written the media off as just another form of politics. That's not good news. If we are perceived to be another form of politics, that's not our job. And we've got to get back in that lane, and that entails lots of work, I think.
So let's talk about the actual way you go about your reporting, which is what I'm so fascinated in. And I think a lot of people in the general public are really interested now in how investigative reporters do their job. You have a note to readers at the beginning of the book that explains the principle of deep background. Do you want to explain what that
is? It means I interview people on deep background that I'm going to, and I tape recorded all these interviews with people with their knowledge, and it means I can use it, but I'm not going to say where it came from. And people have guessed sources. One of the facts is that three of the best sources I had for this book, their names never appear in the book. And quite frankly, is over the last 10 or 12 years, I've reexamined my process of reporting. And it was the fourth Bush book. So 10 years ago, there was a general who wouldn't talk to me, four-star general. And I sent messages, phone messages, intermediaries, radio silence. So I thought, I'm going to use the old Watergate technique of going, knocking on the door. So I found out where he lived. Now, when would you go visit a four-star general without an appointment?
Well, I should say I know how the story ends.
So. Oh, okay, okay, you do. But okay, so we'll disqualify you. Yeah. Okay. Some people will suggest the morning, and I'll say, you know, stick to your line of work because you don't want
to. Well, I'm glad I didn't answer it.
You don't want to interfere with the general's physical training. And so it turns out the best time to go is 8:17 at night on a Tuesday.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, you because you don't want to go on Monday, and you don't want to go at the end of the week, and Tuesdays are perfect. 8:15, 8:17, if the general's home, he will have eaten. Maybe he had a few pops. Relax. Those are the extra hours, so I go knock on his door. And can I quote him?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. He opened the door, and he looked at me, and he said, "Are you still doing this?"
What'd you say?
Well, it was sincere. And what, from lots of CIA reporting with people who are CIA case officers, they tell you, it's important to let the silence suck out the truth. You just have to learn to be quiet. I have a little technique of sticking this finger into my little finger nail so it hurts, and it's a memory aid to tell me to shut the F up and listening. And so I did this, and I poker-faced, and he looked at me, and he's got a disappointed look on his face. I think not in me, but in himself, because he said, "Okay, come on in." Sat for 2 hours and answered questions. Now, why? Because somebody showed up. We're not showing up. I'll bet you find reporters. I asked a reporter some time ago, well-known, I said, "When you go out for interviews?" And he said, "Oh, no, I don't go out for interviews. I do."
Don't say it.
I know. You must hate it.
I hate it so much.
Yeah.
The email.
Right.
Emails everything.
You send the White House a query by email, and then four assistant press secretaries sit around the computer and say, "How can we write two sentences that say nothing?" And that's what you get. You get a bleached out, laundered version, or, you know, this telephone sometimes can help and sometimes is necessary. You've got to show up. It takes time to show up, and you get lots of no's. But when I was working on fear, there was a real, for me personally, an important fork in the road moment. It's 11 o'clock at night, and I had the home number of somebody in the White House who was key. And I said, "Oh, you know, should I call him? You know, 11 o'clock at night, that's late." And then I thought, "Oh, well," at this point I was 74 years old. I said, "Go to bed. You should go to bed." And out of nothing other than momentum, I had the number, and there's the phone, and I dialed. And he answered, and I said, identified myself, "Would like to come talk to you about the Trump White House." And he said, yeah, "You call the office tomorrow, the brush off." And I said, "Well, I'm 4 minutes from your house." He said, "4 minutes from my house? How do you know where I live?" And I said, "Well, good research." And so he said, "Okay, come on by." And so at 11:04, I showed up at his door, and luck, you know, luck in anything. His wife was out of town, and I stayed. It wasn't dawn, but it was almost dawn. And then went and got some sleep and came back the next morning. And you've got to get into people's homes. You've got to, if you're the Assistant Secretary of Defense and I come to interview you, what am I going to say to you? What are potent words in journalism?
I have a source.
No.
I have a document.
No,
oh,
see?
This is like going to college again. The
most potent words in journalism are, I need your help.
Yeah.
I need your help. Because it's true. And it immediately, you know, if you start, I got the goods on you. I've got the document. I've got, you know, that's bad human interaction, I think. But I need your help is honest and works. And so you say, okay, come on by the Pentagon. Now, I'm going to not just Google you, but I'm going to find out a lot about you. And I'm going to have the article you wrote for Defense Weekly 32 years ago. And I'm going to say, on page 18, you say the following. And you might think, I thought only my mother read that article. And it's not a ruse. It's something I want to know. I want to take you as seriously as you take yourself, right? You take yourself seriously. So you, and by showing a genuine interest in who you are and what you think and then what you know, maybe you're a backbencher in the White House sitting there taking notes. And if it's useful, I'll ask to come back and then 1 week, I'll call you at home and say, you know, we didn't get to meet on Tuesday at 8:17, but can I come by? And you may say no, you may say yes. And what the formula for dealing with Trump people, the closer they are, the more anxiety and distress they have about what's going on. And so if you can find those people and develop that relationship of trust, you have a chance of getting diaries and notes. And you've looked at the book. I quote endlessly from notes and diaries. And the Secretary of State sent this memo, and this is what it said, and so forth. And those are the
built.
Pardon?
There's also a lot of dialogue in the book. That's, you know, when we put something in quotes, we're pretty sure that's exactly how it was said.
Yes.
And there's a lot of dialogue in
this book. Yes, there is. There's less than people think because I paraphrase. And then people will say, you know, I remember exactly what was said. Or here are my notes. People in the White House, it's a moment in the sun for them. And there's some things you remember and they... People take documents home at night, and they'll always deny it. And on about the fourth interview, I remember one person said, you know, just, I want to get the date of that. Do you have, oh, well, maybe I have something upstairs. And so he goes upstairs, and he came down. Boxes. And, you know, if the FBI ever got those documents, I was drooling over them because they're so significant building blocks of authoritative journalism, but none of these things are perfect engineer's drawings, but what we call the best obtainable version of the truth.
So you're no stranger to the fake news slur or accusation. It happened during Watergate. It happened even with this book and this president.
Yeah.
How do you think the discrediting of the media has changed over the last, or has it?
Yeah, it's the old Nixon strategy. Nixon did the same thing and would say, send Ron Ziegler, his press secretary, and say, this is, they were not as skilled as Trump is. They didn't have the term fake news, but it was, we're character assassins, or we make things up, or the sources are a fountain of misinformation, whatever that means. And Trump has now a high-tech, well-calibrated version of making the issue the conduct of the news media rather than his conduct. And he sold lots of people on it. And that's where we have to, in our business, kind of calm down, be more empirical, and find a way kind of back by just being factual. Facts, facts, facts. They really do matter.
Do you think that it's possible to restore faith in the media to where it was at the height of the Watergate reporting?
I think the truth emerges, and these are accurate accounts of Trump, and now people don't want to deal with it and so forth. I wrote something out. I read to you because I wanted to. This struck me. I was in Los Angeles, that suburb of San Francisco, and last night, and a friend of mine I had dinner with, and who used worked at the Post for years, and he said, "Don't lose sight that journalism is a moral pursuit," and he said, "Now it is a moral pursuit, but it can't be moralistic or self-righteous." And he said, "The job of journalism is to locate truth, fairness, empathy, find a voice for the people who have less power." I agree with that. I think that's true. I know we make lots of mistakes. I make mistakes too often, but this work is done in good faith. And that's going to, Trump's charges, whatever he doesn't like, he will say it's fake news or we're the enemy of the people. I have known thousands of journalists. We're not the enemy of the people. And we have a product that lots of people don't like and don't trust. And so what we have to do is make the product better, like anyone.
Yeah, well said. So recently Congress has been getting into the issue of helping the media. We have a proposal out there for a Journalist Protection Act, which would make it a federal crime to attack journalists. And then there's also...
Right. Now, that's how many votes it would get in Congress. I mean, is this a joke? No, okay.
And there's also the Journalism Competition and Preservation Act that would allow smaller outlets to join together and get rid of some antitrust rules and allow them to negotiate with Google and Facebook. What do you think about Congress trying to give the media a leg up on anything?
Well, they do so many things so well. No, thank you.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is investigative journalist Bob Woodward, whose latest book is Fear, Trump in the White House. He's joined in conversation by Audrey Cooper, editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
This is a little bit of a long story, but it's something that's lived with me for a long time. And we try to get the facts, and then we try to take the facts and what we've seen or reported and say, this is what it means. And that's what we often get wrong. And there was this goes way back. It was September 1974. Gerald Ford was president. Nixon had resigned in August. And Ford, president maybe 30 days, and he went on television on a Sunday morning announcing he was giving Nixon a full pardon for Watergate. Now, I think Ford went on television early on a Sunday morning hoping no one would notice. but it was noticed, but not by me. I was asleep, and Bernstein called me up, woke me up. Carl always knows how to say what occurred in the fewest words with the most drama. Said, "The son of a bitch pardoned the son of a bitch." You wouldn't allow that in your newspaper, but it did convey the message. And I was proud of myself for a while because so that's what happened. And I thought, it's perfect. The final corruption of Watergate. Nixon gets a pardon, and Ford gets the presidency. There was an aroma of a deal. It was denied, but it was too cute, right? And I would have staked my life at that time on my conclusion that this was corrupt. And then 2 years later, Ford ran against Jimmy Carter and lost, largely because of the pardon and the distrust. So 25 years later, after 1974, so it's 1999, 2000, I undertook one of my book projects, Shadow, about the legacy of Watergate in the presidencies of Ford through Clinton, and called Gerald Ford up. And I'd never interviewed him, never met him. At the time, in the 70s, there was a big poster in the news conference room of the Washington Post that the classified ad department put up. Remember when newspapers had classified ads?
It was before my time. Honestly. So
I believe it. I believe it. And it was a picture of Jerry Ford saying, "I got my job through the Washington Post." Shameless.
When you called him up, did you say, "I need your help"?
Yes, I did. I did. And figured he would. And said, "I want to talk about the pardon figurine." Now, this is 25 years later, 23 years after he'd left the presidency. And so we set up interviews. I had the luxury of time to two full-time assistants, get all the memoirs, contemporary coverage. 7 interviews with Ford. He had a home in Colorado, one in Rancho Mirage, California, and I would write drafts and then go see him. In the last interview, I remember in his little, he had a little den in his one-story house and a tape recorder going for history. And I said, asked, "Why'd you pardon Nixon?" And he said, "Oh, you keep asking that question." And I said, "Well, I really don't think you've answered completely." And to my astonishment, he said, "You're right. I haven't even told Betty, his wife, this story." But history should know how what happened behind the scenes that was very secret. And he said, "So a week before Nixon resigned, Al Haig, Nixon's chief of staff, came to see him, Ford. Ford was vice president at that point in August. And Al Haig said, 'Look, if you agree to pardon Nixon, he'll resign, you get the presidency.'" And I'm sitting there and I go, "There was a deal." And I said this to Ford and he exploded and said, "There was no deal. I tell you, I knew that would be corrupt. And more importantly," he said, "I knew Nixon was finished. I was going to get the presidency anyway. Anyone offer you a deal and say, 'Oh, you're going to get something you know is going to come your way.'" And then I said, "But why? What happened?" And then he went on this monologue that was so interior about what he'd kept and the nature and the state of play. And he said, I became president, never wanted to become president, wanted to be Speaker of the House. That I was president and the economy was in trouble. It was the middle of the Cold War. He had a letter from Leon Jaworski, who was the Watergate prosecutor, saying we're going to investigate Nixon as a private citizen because of the tapes and the damning thousands of hours of secret tape recordings. Surely we'll be indicted, tried, convicted, maybe go to jail. So Ford said, so we're going to have two or three more years of Watergate. And he said in this plaintive voice, I needed my own presidency. The country needed to move on. It was essential. And he said, as president, I realized I had some, just not ancillary duties, but I had a prime responsibility of what is in the national interest. And we had to get Nixon off the front page. And he said, I was haunted by everything Nixon. And we had to get Nixon into history, and I had this pardon power, and so I exercised it. And I did it, and what I believe, and he said, I knew I was going to get slaughtered for politically, and I could never disclose that Haig had come and offered a deal, because then there'd be investigations, and there would. And so I acted preemptively in what I thought was the national interest. I wrote in the book Shadow that, in fact, what Ford did was quite gutsy. Caroline Kennedy, the daughter of the late President John F. Kennedy, called me up and said she and her uncle Teddy Kennedy had read this in the book. And she said, each year we give a Profiles in Courage Award to somebody in politics named after her late father, the late president, his book, Profiles in Courage, about eight politicians who killed their own political careers by doing what they deemed in the national interest. And so they gave this award to Ford. I didn't go, but I watched it. It was televised. There was some video of it. And what a cold shower for me. To be fully honest, how humbling, how humiliating to be so wrong. Because in 1974, as I said, I would have staked my life that this was corrupt. Then you look at it afresh through 25 years of history, go at it patiently, know that the key is one person. Gerald Ford keeps showing up and saying, what happened, really, why? And what I was sure was corruption turns out to be courage. You can't have that experience in our business and not live in a state where the pause button is always on, that gee, we think we know, but we maybe don't. And when Trump was elected, I knew it was a pivot point in history. Dropped all work for the Washington Post, some other projects, got off television, and went into the night knocking to try to find out the best obtainable version of the truth from people and from their documentation, because I knew I had better not wait 25 years before doing that story and that book.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight, and I think I speak for everybody that we're very much looking forward to the second Trump book.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was investigative journalist Bob Woodward, whose latest book is Fear, Trump in the White House. He was joined in conversation by Audrey Cooper, editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.